Hello, and welcome to Marching On, the podcast brought to you by the ACLU of Kansas. I'm Esme Tsung, Communications Director at the ACLU of Kansas. Thank you for joining us for this special episode. Perhaps the most persistent, most prevalent, and most potent threat to our civil liberties comes from our criminal legal system. From policing to pretrial detention to our flawed court processes to inside the prison walls to the post-release surveillance state, every step of this oppression poses a constant threat to our civil liberties and our community's ability to create what really heals us and what really keeps us safe. To help us illuminate and address the multitude of issues, the ACLU of Kansas recently held a justice summit in Wichita. This event was primarily focused on the broken process of cash bail, centered around our recent report, The Price of Freedom, which took an in-depth look at the disparities and inequities of bail in Sedgwick County. One of the highlights of the event was a conversation between our ACLU of Kansas Executive Director Micah Kubik and Yasmin Cater, Deputy Legal Director at ACLU National. Yasmin directs the Trone Center for Justice and Equality, which encompasses the National Prison Project, the Criminal Law Reform Project, the Racial Justice Program, the Capital Punishment Project, the John Adams Project, and the Abortion Criminal Defense Initiative. Today's episode features an illuminating discussion between Micah and Yasmin, where they discuss not only the flaws and the impacts of bail, but also the larger issues that permeate the whole criminal legal system and its impact on racial minorities and the poor, as well as the work we're doing at the ACLU to fix it in Kansas and nationwide. So without further ado, here are Micah and Yasmin.
She is one of the most fearless and effective crusaders for justice in America today. She has had a 30-year career as a civil rights lawyer and a public defender in some very tough places, in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Los Angeles. She was a public defender in New York during the infamous and deeply racist stop and frisk policy that was going on there. She has represented all sorts of clients as a public defender. She has been in private practice as a lawyer, and she came to the ACLU a few years ago. Most importantly of all, she is a graduate of Howard University. And received her law degree from Yale. So I hope that you will please give a very warm Wichita welcome to a great lawyer, a great advocate, and a great friend, Yasmin Cater. So we're going to have a little conversation today, and we're going to talk a bunch about bail. We're going to talk a bunch about criminal justice. But before we do that, I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit more about your own journey. You've had a very illustrious career, fascinating journey through all different types of the law. So what drew you to the law? What drew you to being a public defender? What drew you to this work of justice?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you so much for having me. It really is an honor. I'm so excited to have the conversation with you. When you reached out, you said favor. You know, you say jump, I say how high. And that's really because of both your leadership, what the ACLU's presence in Kansas does and what it means, and also just how important it is to look at being connected to what is really the front lines of the movement for racial justice and criminal justice. So I want to say thank you. In terms of what drew me to the law, you know, you mentioned Howard University, and you and I both were students there, and I was an undergraduate student there, and I took classes in Frederick Douglass Hall, literally. I took classes in Elaine Locke Hall. I studied in Founders Library in the same room where Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston and Pauli Murray's influence was very much there to devise some of the most core constitutional principles that we rely upon today. So I was seeped in that tradition as an undergraduate, and that inspired me to go to law school. And I was drawn very much to civil rights law and started my career in the Justice Department in the employment litigation section of the Civil Rights Division. And it was great. It was wonderful. It was exciting. It was kind of sexy. I used to have my justice credentials and I could flash them and fly around the country and be like, here I am.
And back when the Civil Rights Division was
playing. Right, back when there was a Civil Rights Division. This is in the early 90s. But what I saw happening in the world at the same time that I had this, you know, very prestigious role was I was in the District of Columbia. And in Superior Court, right down the street from the Justice Department, was really in many ways just an emblematic center of the war on drugs and the fueling of mass incarceration, where predominantly, almost exclusively, Black people who were in extreme poverty were being funneled through that front door, not to return, and not to return for decades. And so I felt very, very called to that work, to what really felt like the front line. So I traded in my fancy credentials. I took a big old, like a 30% pay cut, and was driving my little Honda around Southeast DC investigating cases. And I figured I'm going to go do this for a couple of years and we'll see what's next. And then, you know, a 23-year career as a public defender came after that. So that's the best laid plans, right?
Thank you for sharing that story with us. So I want to move into the substance of criminal justice reform and note that a few years ago, it seemed like this phrase criminal justice reform was everywhere. It was all the rage. There were panels, there were discussions, there were comments. Everywhere you turned around, people were talking about criminal justice reform. It seemed for a while there was an emerging consensus that reform was needed. And that crossed over party and ideology. We are, of course, in Wichita, the home of Koch Industries, where for a long time there was this belief that there was an opportunity to cross over ideology, and the Koch network was part of that. But in the last couple of years, it seems like something has changed, that something has shifted, and the topic isn't quite front of mind the way that it was a few years ago. I want to ask you first whether you agree with my assessment, and if so, what do you think happened? What changed? What brought us to this point?
Mike, I think it depends on who you're talking to, but in what context. But I think that one thing that we know for sure that is still agreed upon is that we are still the world's largest incarcerator. You know, the United States has 4% of the world's population, yet we have 20% of the incarcerated people. So that still is true. And in terms of the motivation for change, there's no doubt that there was a movement that has been going on for, you know, 15 years of facing the idea that we need to make a shift. I mean, when I started as a public defender, no one talked about mass incarceration. And in fact, you know, those were the days when there was bipartisan agreement for mass incarceration, asking for higher sentences, asking for mandatory minimums. That was a bipartisan agreement. And then we have had a shift and a reckoning. And we really reached our apex of our numbers in 2008. And to date, there is a 20% decrease from those numbers. So that's better. But, you know, as they say, you can't fall far out of the basement window. We still have a lot of work to do. And so when I think about people's shift in terms of making it the urgent moment of the day or the priority of what they're doing, sometimes I think that there is exhaustion from the complexity of the problem. You can't address criminal legal justice, however you want to call it, reform and change, if you're also not looking at repairing the decades of abandonment that we have of our people and our communities in every other area, in housing justice, in terms of economic justice, in terms of employment, in terms of education. These are all inextricably intertwined. Our society often dumps the rest of those unsolved problems over into the criminal legal system and say, we're just going to lock everybody up. And so that carceral sentiment is not something we've been able to divorce ourselves from yet. And I also want to put it in context of some of the conversations that we've been having in this country right now about authoritarianism. There is a lot of comparisons to other nations and other countries and other democracies, democracies that have fallen, democracies that weren't able to get off the ground, and, you know, concern about our own democracy right now. But we have lessons to be learned here on how to combat that from our own experience with systems of authoritarianism. In this country, we had slavery. You know, this country, we had Jim Crow. right? And we had mass and have mass incarceration, which are all systems of authoritarianism. And so we, when you think about what is the long-term effort of having bipartisan support, I mean, I think that that is something that we need to really tap on our own experiences. And sometimes when you're trying to defeat a system, it isn't always, you're not always going to have the foot on the gas at full speed as it should. Look at Reconstruction, right? And then we had a moment in this country of extreme change and opportunity and promise to be made, to be followed by decades of post-Reconstruction vitriol and violence and subjugation and using the carceral system as a form of taking people and subjugating them. So I guess that's a long answer to your question of why has it seemed to go out of fashion. But I think that it's because it took a long time to build our system, and it's going to take a long concerted effort to take it down. And we are all here for it.
So I especially love how you tied back to our history right here. We had one Reconstruction. We had a second Reconstruction with the civil rights. I think we're about to have a third one, actually. We need one for sure. You also talked a little bit about authoritarianism there, right? So I think in this particular moment, lots of folks are thinking about a bunch of different issues. There's a new attack every day, a new attack on civil rights and civil liberties every day. Some folks may have seen this sort of buffoonish speech that happened this morning at the Pentagon. And so there's a lot of discussion right now about the rule of law when we're concerned about that democratic backsliding. How do you see the work around the rule of law? How do you see that narrow, like that framing that people use about the importance of the rule of law intersecting with criminal justice reform and these issues?
Well, I see two things. And first, I want to focus on this moment. I mean, we are in an extraordinary time. And one of my colleagues, Ben Weisner, likes to say, you know, we get asked all the time, are we in a constitutional crisis? Well, if we stop fighting, we are. But if we keep going and we keep punching back, that's how you prevent one. And so the ACLU is at every one of these intersections. I mean, we are, you know, standing up for birthright citizenship. We are centrally involved in the Alien Enemies Act cases. We filed the case in Los Angeles and had some victory for a time in the lower courts on the racial profiling of ICE agents against the Latino community. We are there combating, you know, the separation of powers violations in all kinds of contexts, including, you know, in standing up, and most importantly, I would say, for the First Amendment in, you know, in terms of protecting what people can learn and the attacks on schools and standing up for science. And we are there for all of that. And that is central core work to protect our constitutional democracy. And we are continuing our everyday strategic plan to be constitutional warriors in our work in criminal legal system change. Those things are different and they are the same in that the people who are in these small courthouses every day exacting justice, insisting on constitutional rights, fighting for the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, for due process in driver license suspension cases, in bail, which we're going to talk about more, in terms of over-policing and combating that, standing up for the rule of law there, and for constitutional protections, that's Constitutional Warrior 101 as well.
So I do want to move to bail in just a second. But first, I want to ask you just a little bit about some other high-level priorities that you see in the criminal legal reform work right now. You lead the Trone Center, which presides over all of these cases all over the country, right? So aside from bail, what are some other of those high-level priorities to be that constitutional warrior right now?
You know, the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division has really walked away from some of the most important work that it had and its obligation to protect civil rights and civil liberties in this country, including in terms of policing. we can't fill that entire gap, but we can do our part. We have a seven states campaign right now where we are in seven cities across this country filing Freedom of Information Act requests to find out what's going on in those police departments where there had been findings under the last administration and reports, and they were getting ready to move toward litigation and they didn't get there. So we're trying to pick that up. So policing is still a very, very urgent matter. We're going to talk more about pretrial justice, but that is a priority for us. We're involved across this country in efforts of having constitutional standards met in jurisdictions for pretrial justice. The death penalty matters so much, and I cannot overemphasize that. I think last year there were 25 executions in the entire year, which is atrocious. I think we're already at 30. The last count right now to this year. And the harm of the death penalty is unconstitutional. It just drives extreme sentences so that you find people grateful for a life without parole sentence because they're saving themselves, from the death penalty. That should not be the measurement of what's rational or fair or right or just, or is at all consistent with parsimony or other principles of sentencing, of rehabilitation, of appropriate punishment, of deterrence. All of these principles that we know are evidence-based, the death penalty is just completely destroying. So I think it's very important for us, and we do have a focus nationwide on the death penalty, both in terms of our involvement in individual cases as well as systemic challenges. We're really focused on the whole concept of attacks on Gideon and right to counsel, not just in the context of bail, but everywhere else. I mean, we have to really think about what we have taken for granted and what is potentially being challenged right now. We take for granted in this country that if a person can't afford a lawyer, the court will appoint a lawyer for them. That is not something that we should take for granted. It is a doctrine that must be protected, that we must make sure is ingrained and enshrined, and then is meaningful, right? So if you have an overburdened public defender's office, and that's work that we're also focused on, you can't give meaningful representation. So that's something that's also really urgent.
The puppet's business table is right over there. So
my people, But then also the intersection of immigration enforcement and criminal law. I mean, we see all of these abuses from traffic stops to profiling to all of these, weaponization of the criminal legal system to then have this inhumane and unconstitutional and frankly violative of basic due process rights happening in ICE enforcement. So there's my priorities. How's that?
That was a lot. All right. So let's talk a little more specifically about bail then. This morning, we've already heard a little bit about how bail works or does not work in Wichita, some of the enormous racial disparities that exist here. But what is the problem with the cash bail system nationwide? What is so objectionable about this thing?
It's so un-American. It's just so un-American. We are not a country that punishes poverty, at least not in our ideals, not in who we're supposed to be. And so it creates a two-tier system of justice. And that is just so contrary to what this country is supposed to be about and what, when it is at its best, it is about. And so it is punishing poverty. It creates a two-tier system of justice. It creates racial disparities. And it also entrenches people in cycles of poverty, where if a person is detained even for a couple of days, it can disrupt so much getting on one's feet, keeping your job, being there for your children. I mean, I have so many stories, from being a defender for all that time in all these different cities of, looking across when you meet your client. Often there's glass or there's a screen. And, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about, okay, how am I going to get you out? That's the first most urgent issue is how can I get you out on bail? Because what I know and what my clients know is how are you going to fight your case from inside? People need to be in the community to fight their case. But I have to tell you, that was not always the most important thing on my clients' minds. So often it was, who's going to take care of my mom? Can you please call my job and get somebody to back up because my boss is depending on me? My child needs to be picked up from school. And so, when you think about just this concept of taking someone out of the community when there is a presumption of innocence and when doing so, we're not even oftentimes having an assessment of ability to pay a cash bail, nor are we even having a fair hearing with representation to talk about, are there no conditions or combination of conditions that can ensure this person's reappearance in court and or the safety of the community? Is that true? I mean, that is such a high standard. So, you know, it is just such a critical analysis that we have to have, and such an important part of when you're talking about a fair and just process to have accountability, have justiciability, you know, to hold people accountable for what they have and haven't done, to uphold the role of law. If we run roughshod over the Constitution and people's rights at that point of pretrial detention, we're making a mockery of our own system, and we can't do that.
Yes. So I love that. Like, I love that. So it's un-American. We should not cede our values to somebody else. Let us not let them define for us what it means to be American and what our values are. I love that. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the efforts that the ACLU and the Trone Center are leading around the country on bail reform? Tell us a little bit about ones there that you're especially excited about, proud of, worried about, any of the above.
Well, okay. I'm excited about all of it, because I know that sometimes even if you don't prevail in this moment, in this particular lawsuit or this effort, there is such a value to the fight nonetheless, because of the important energy and the upholding of these values to your community. And I am so proud of the ACLU and of our center's leadership in pretrial justice. And so we are in Georgia. And in Georgia, we are really combating an effort right now to expand this cash bail system to 30 more offenses, right? Where there's going to be a schedule. And we are combating that right now. We are in Oregon, where we are on the cusp of, I believe, a really good outcome, where there's going to be an assessment of an ability to pay for the first time in some of those courtrooms, where that kind of justice is going to come. And we're in Texas, where we're fighting very hard for there to be right to counsel at first appearance. You know, one of the things we were talking about last night when we were talking is I had a very cushy public defender practice. I was in D.C. in Superior Court. I was in federal court in New York, and I was in federal court in L.A. And everybody got a bail hearing. Everybody had counsel. Everybody had an opportunity to go in front of the judge and make their case. Now, it wasn't just, and it wasn't fair, and it wasn't a situation where there weren't extraordinary disparities, and there wasn't extraordinary and kind of just ignoring of people's humanity. But at least the system and the process was in place to be able to hold the system accountable and at least force it to face its failures. So when I've come into this work and I see that there's courtrooms across this country where you have just cash bail, you don't have, without an assessment of a person's ability to pay, that's just irrational. The idea that you don't have counsel at first appearance to protect you, that's not what our founders intended. It just isn't. You know, when we think about these principles of due process and the Fourth Amendment, and we think about, you know, the right to counsel, there's a deep and understandable critique of the moral failings of the authors of our constitutional principles. You know, they were engaged in enslavement. You know, they were engaged in repression. They were complicated people, as we say. But they also, when they fashioned those concepts of civil liberties, they may not have intended them to apply to me or my family. Instead, they intended them to apply to themselves. They were thinking about what would happen to them if they were at the other end of the government's finger, because we know how politically charged the country was at the founding. And they're good. They did a really good job. You know, when you think about this protection from majoritarian rule that our liberties promote, you know, our First Amendment free speech rights, you know, even when it's controversial and something that the majority of people hate, that is a protection. When we think about the protection of presumption of innocence, I mean, how many people have ever been on a jury or thought about being on a jury or watched a jury show? And, you know, at the end, the defense lawyer says, I don't care whether you think he did it or whether you figure he did it, or you assume he did it. No, that is not our country's standards. You are to presume this person innocent from the moment they walk into the courtroom until you go into that jury room. And only does that presumption fade only if you find them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The highest standard in our land. That is, you know, those are civil liberties and protections that are just so much about the protection of the vulnerable and the marginalized and the person who is at the other end of the government's finger when the United States with all of its power comes. So I think that remembering pretrial justice in the same way, you see, I am quite a patriot, right? I think we all are patriots who fight for these principles to apply fairly and justly.
I feel like a banner should unfurl now and an eagle should soar and
wave the flag.
Right. But I also think it's important to note one of the things you said there, right, is that there are other places that have done these things, right? Like, it is not crazy to assume that a local jurisdiction could make counsel available, right?
It's not from a constitutional perspective or a policy perspective or an efficiency perspective. I mean, here we go, right? Let's talk brass tacks. Let's talk policy. Let's talk about money and responsible shepherding of taxpayer dollars, right? Responsible shepherding of taxpayer dollars says, should we just enforce cash bail, which is hurting our communities? It's impeding our workforce. It is disrupting our families. Or should we have an assessment? Can this person even pay? And we should have an assessment. Are they going to come back? Are they from this community? Do they have ties to this community? Have they ever fled before? Or maybe not. Maybe they've always, even if they have a long criminal record, they've always come back, or they have no criminal record and no reason to believe that they won't, right? And are they a danger to the community? When I was looking at those statistics from your report, you have so many people sitting in pretrial detention on nonviolent offenses. So just talking brass tacks about money, I mean, these jails and the staff it takes to continue to house people and do so and then take and have to combat, you know, cases from the ACLU that will come and sue you if you have terrible conditions for those folks. I mean, it's just not a sound policy. And we have to reckon with the other reality, right? We can sit in here and have an agreement amongst ourselves and, you know, all have our amen choir, right? But there's people in the world who see it differently. And one thing that we do know that is going to happen in our system of justice is that there's somebody who's going to get on bail and is going to commit a new crime. It's not us holding our breath, hoping it doesn't happen. No, we know it will happen because that is how human nature works. People continue to fall down. And that is just a reality. So we have to design our strategies and our persuasive muscles to not just accommodate for that, but embrace it. And so I think that there's two parts of that. There's thinking ahead and being able to tell effectively the stories of the 99 people who got out on bail, who were able to combat their case and then resolve their case and remain in the community and continue to work and care for their children. And maybe they had to go do time, but they had that time out to be able to get themselves and their families ready. We need to tell those stories loud over and over and over again so that that is in the ecosystem along with that one person who went out and committed, let's say, an atrocious violent crime while on bail. Okay? So it's the power of that storytelling. It's the truth. So that's thing one. But the other thing as a movement we need to be very self-reflective about is people don't feel safe. And we have to ask ourselves why. Shouting at people telling them crime is down doesn't work, right? Because especially in some of other parts of the country, when you have the result of decades of abandonment and you have cities that are dealing with high levels of disorder, it makes people feel unsafe. It doesn't mean that they are in the sense of violent crime, but we have to be caring in that part of our system as well. And one of the things I'm very concerned about is a movement from mass incarceration to forced receiverships. Right? And other abandonment of liberty, you know, when we're having these encampment sweeps and we're violating the Fourth Amendment and we're just moving people from one place to another and we're not addressing the systemic issues that have so many people without homes and have so many people who are forced to live, not having meaningful mental health treatment, you know, that is a really important part of the puzzle that we have to really address. That when I'm looking around corners, that's what I'm looking at.
So I wonder if we could talk for just a moment about racial disparities in the bail system.
We've heard today that they're abusing organized racial disparities here. What's your thought? But that is not unique. That is the case all over the country. Tell us what we need to know about why that is, what we can do about it. What's the problem with race in the criminal justice system?
We have to look at the legacy and the long decades, again, of abandonment, the legacy of discrimination, the legacy of keeping people out of opportunity. And I think it's so important whenever we are thinking of a criminal justice reform that we think about how is this going to help everybody? And how is it going to account for poverty? How is it going to account for discrimination? How is it going to account and bake into the solution an effort to be very mindful of that. I remember when my oldest was 4 and he said to me, "Mommy, how come all the homeless people are Black? And how do you explain, you know, the legacy of systemic discrimination? How do you explain the intersection of poverty and race and lack of opportunity? How do you do that to a 4-year-old? But we started, you know. It's, again, it's about not just making people feel bad, you know, not just making people look at something and want to turn away, but having us all invest in this as part of the solution of creating a multicultural, engaged democracy. I truly believe, you know, I was a trial lawyer for a long time, and I had 12 people in the box, right, that I had to convince of something. And I gained deep respect for humanity and deep respect for the openness of people to get out of their own particular context and look at the world and wanted to make it a better place. I represented people who had done things that were really atrocious, who I saw change in front of my eyes, who I saw make dramatic strides. We are so much more than our entrenched beliefs or our mistakes. We as human beings in our nature, I believe, are good. And it's about how do we reach people to want to have the country that we were all promised, which is a thriving, multiracial democracy.
So obviously we are here in Wichita. We are here in Kansas, not necessarily the place that people immediately go to when they think about bail reform, when they think about these stories about where criminal justice reform movements are happening. We're not always the first one that they think of. Where do you see Kansas or states like it in the sort of political and legal environment that we have fitting into the national landscape about bail and justice and this reclaiming of values that you've been talking about?
I see it at the center. I mean, you know, I work at a national organization. I live on the coast, you know. I go to one coast to another coast. But I'm from the middle of the country. I'm from Minnesota. And I saw one of the most important movements that this country has ever had come out of Minnesota, right? I mean, one of the most monumental movements that the world has ever seen come out of the middle of the country. So I see it being the front line. I mean, Kansas just had major civil forfeiture reform, you know, that is being discussed across this country, for example. You know, that was monumental. You know, one of the benefits of the ACLU is that we have a presence in every single state. And what we know is that's where reform is born and is developed and it evolves. It doesn't come from the so-called top down, you know? And so I see Kansas, I see Wichita, I see Kansas City. That's the center. It's the front line and it's where the law gets made, you know? And that's and what you can achieve and what you can, as they say, have a proof of concept for, right? Where you make a change, you collect the data, you show how it works, and then you expand it. I mean, that is all local efforts. And when we're talking about the criminal legal system is a local system, right? I mean, there is a federal system as well, but the vast majority of people who are incarcerated or who are facing any type of prison sentence or anything are coming through state systems. So it's the center, literally.
And that's why you have postcards to Mark Bennett at the center of your tables. So I want to ask you, what gives you hope right now in times that can be a little distressing, that can be a little depressing at times? What gives you hope and what makes you still that patriot that you said you were a moment ago?
I think a lot about Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells and Sojourner Truth and Dolores Huerta and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Shirley Chisholm. And all of these shoulders that we are all standing on, right? And I think about how they had hope in extraordinarily challenging times. I mean, I think about Frederick Douglass, right? This man fought for abolition and emancipation. And then he went on to fight for Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment. And he saw it, right? To then turn around and see the vitriol and the beginnings of Jim Crow and lynching and violence. And yet and still, he was a suffragist. He was a coalition builder like no other. And he continued to have hope. In one of his last speeches, he said, I paraphrase, I could sit down right now. I could sit down. I am so disheartened and heartbroken at what this country has done. I could think that it could never make it. But when I think about the founding and I think about the autocrats across the waters who were shaking at their boots at a concept of a nation that would uphold liberty and equality, egalitarian principles, and they were shaking in their boots, then I think we're going to be okay. It's just a long road.
Thank you to Micah and Yasmin, and an extra huge thank you to Yasmin for traveling across half the country to join us for the Justice Summit event. As always, we want to end this episode by giving you a way to take action. So if you live in Sedgwick County, you can use our form to encourage officials to change pretrial policies. Taking just a couple minutes to do so could make a big difference in helping us show widespread support for these reforms. You can find that form at aclukansas.org and by clicking on Take Action. If you don't live in Sedgwick County, you can still visit aclukansas.org and take action for criminal legal reform, as well as voting rights, as long as you're there. Remember, you're not limited to one form, so please feel free to take multiple actions to amplify your impact. That does it for this episode. Tune in next month for more conversations with the people who are at the heart of the movement working for civil rights in Kansas. And until next time, keep marching on.